got me. And all that we could do with this emotion fantasy. All right, guys, good morning. Good Thursday morning here. Got a lot to talk about today. Welcome to episode 5 of Storytime with Tofu. Probably as those numbers get higher, I'm probably going to stop saying them because hopefully we'll be around long enough so we won't need to. That was a little early morning Carly Rae Jepsen. She has a new album that dropped this, I guess more towards the end of summer. It's absolutely fantastic. Emotion is definitely my favorite song, but again, distractions. Okay, so every Tuesday, there's a new episode of The Flash. Every Wednesday, there's a new episode of Arrow. And because I haven't got a chance to podcast about The Nick yet, we're also going to be doing that today as well. So, Flash just aired its third episode. Arrow also just aired its third episode this week. But I'm going to just cover my bases here. So both of those shows are in the new CW comic book universe. You've heard me talk about them before. They're both doing very, very well. I think, well, I don't know if anyone can beat The Vampire Diaries, but they're definitely at the forefront of the higher ratings, the higher rated CW series. I'm trying to think of, like, yeah, Rain has okay numbers, Heart of Dixie has okay numbers, Supernatural still has its fan base, and The Originals and The Vampire Diaries are still very, very popular, but there is a very huge following of both, you know, traditional CW fans, as well as more comic book fans attaching to these new series. Arrow, which is now on its fourth season, The Flash, which is on its second season, and an upcoming series, I think, dropping probably in January or I think it's coming out in January, is their new series, their like DC Legends of Tomorrow series, which is so everything, all the comic book series in the CW are in the same universe. But other than that, and also other than that, The Nick is just absolutely fantastic, so we'll make sure to talk about that at the end of this podcast, because it definitely needs its full 10 maybe 15 minutes of content. But anyway, I just wanted to talk first about these two series in the sense that they are, in my opinion, the most successful live-action DC franchise on television, and it's light years ahead of Smallville. I don't want to shame Smallville, because despite how terrible it got after season 4 or 5, you know, the early seasons did deliver that really nicely episodic, not overly not overly focused on like a serial subplot, which actually probably would have helped near the end. They were really bad type of series with this kind of dopey Clark Kent. Honestly, Chloe was the best character on that show. Hashtag Chloe forever. But anyway, that was also on the WB, and that actually did have its run on the CW, because it didn't get canceled after WTV got sold to the or became the CW. But they're the most successful live-action series, and in my opinion, despite what Marvel has done with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Daredevil aside, Daredevil and that whole Netflix universe aside, this is, my opinion, the better TV universe. And I think because you're not playing, they entered in softly. Like, Marvel couldn't enter their you know, movie, Marvel Cinematic Universe softly, because those blockbusters need to, like, sing across the globe. Like, I don't know how Avengers did, but it was definitely a very high-grossing movie, like, globally. Because, you know, they're not super hard to translate, and you know, people are drawn to like action sequences, and I'm not hating on them. I enjoy those movies. I did not hate Age of Ultron. I didn't love it as much as other ones, but I'm getting older. That's, I suppose, to be expected. And despite that, as I was saying, despite having a lower budget, you know, series like The Flash and Green Arrow are just much softer, you know, entrances into these worlds of comic book universes, which are really, really complicated. And, you know, I totally understand, very off-putting. And some people are like, isn't that just so stupid? And I'm just like, you know what? I don't think so, but I don't have arguments against why, you know, you could argue that it is stupid. You know, it's me being, you know, a kid again, or wanting to feel like I'm a kid again, wanting to feel in not necessarily a purely black and white good versus evil environment, but, you know, one where you get your expected justice speech, you get your very fascinating, well-developed villain. You're just like, but all you don't care about is like, oh, how is this guy gonna wreck the world? Like, you know, what is the core being of his character? It's more just like, I just want to see this guy getting taken down in some like old school vigilante justice. But I'm sorry, I'm kind of spiraling out of control with the reminiscing. But my main argument is both the series, as I said in the previous podcast, set up what I like to call the Saturday morning cartoon show type of feel to a series, with, you know, a lot of soapiness, which I think is also a little off-putting to some people who are just like, I don't want to see this. I just want to see bad guys get taken down, or like, if there is that, I want it to be more interesting and not as at times very one-dimensional. But, you know, again, we talk about TV is very very subjective. You know, everyone watches this for a different reason, and arguably, unlike certain shows, I'm pretty much always in a mood to watch both of these shows, as long as like I'm not forcing someone to watch it with me. Like, oh, guys, I need to watch Arrow. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting like this awesome indie film you're watching, or something like that. Miracle Mile, great movie, starring both TV actors from ER that I don't remember, but really interesting, fascinating indie film from the 80s about nuclear destruction. And it was timed very well because I was playing Fallout at the time. But sorry, digressing. Both series create that Saturday morning cartoon feel, which is, you know, you're following this main core group of people. But the goal is, because comic book universes are so big, you can introduce new characters. You can give them a greater feel of like, we're not alone in this dark universe full of endless supervillains. And Arrow, after season one, definitely could have gone either way. And I'm really glad they decided to like expand to a greater universe. And I think it's given them a lot more to play with, and it's going to give them a lot more to sustain these shows for a lot longer, as well as use the source material a lot better. That is what I like about comic books the most. Comic book series, regardless animated or live action, the most, is that you do have to change the source material a lot. But it's, in my opinion, much easier to convey the messages through them, as well as leave many more Easter eggs for your fans. I know a lot of fans of the Green Arrow really don't like the series. Some hardcore comic fans really don't like the series. Some of them usually tend to be in an older echelon who have appreciation more for like the golden era of DC Comics, which I definitely do not have. My appreciation for this universe definitely comes from light reading of big books, but more just a love of the characters. And I, you know, Star Wars fans like to say this a lot too, is like, at the end of the day, what you most love is the idea of Star Wars, the idea of Lord of the Rings, the idea of Harry Potter, regardless or not. You just want to visit that place as often as possible. And to me, Arrow and the Flash are very happy windows into those worlds. I do believe for some other comic book fans, they are just not. They do not light up the same receptors of like nostalgia and joy that I get from watching these shows. So I understand why people don't love it, or why people think it's over the top. So now that that disclaimer's out of the way, let's talk about the really awesome, positive, epic things about these shows. As I was mentioning earlier, doing a series-based series and now connecting both a Flash and Arrow universe in the same like DC, CW comic book universe, they have so much room to play with the lore and meta that is the DC comic book universe. You know, I definitely think when they first started Arrow, they were not going to use, you know, a ton of magic. They were going to use like comic book science, but I don't think they were going to use magic. I don't think they were going to go over the top with powers as they have to now in the Flash series. And both of those things made me incredibly nervous last year when Flash was premiering its first season. Arrow was on its third season, which was going to focus on Ra's al Ghul. And I was like, okay, are they gonna do like what the Dark Knight series did and keep it more along that vein, where like Ra's is just like a brilliant guy leading a cult that's been around for centuries with no like Lazarus pit idea, or are they just gonna step right into it and do the Lazarus pit? And well and behold, Willa Holland is still on the show, and Katie Lotz is now back on the show. They did the Lazarus pit thing. Magic has definitely been soft entrance to last season into this awesome Arrow and Flash universe, as well as metahumans. Like, that is now a term you're just throwing around in this universe. Metahumans was introduced in the Flash universe. And what this does for me, other than give Oliver, you know, a great amount of villains to fight and Arrow around with, is it reminds me of what one of my favorites two series are, or I guess WB series are, which is Batman the Animated Series and Batman Beyond. And the thing that's different about, you know, you can argue that, you know, okay, DC movies are doing their own Superman Batman universe. We're the CW. We don't want those rights. We don't want to deal with that. But we still want to create our same dynamic. The Flash is a very bright show, more along the lines of early Smallville. It's a way better done with, you know, him as a much younger, inexperienced, not confident character, trying to find what it means to be a superhero and, like Superman, control what is, as my friend Kevin loves to point out, literally the most ridiculous and powerful power in the world. He has the Speed Force, which allows him to move faster than light, essentially. The Flash is one of the most powerful characters in the DC universe. He's essentially one of the characters responsible for the entire, within the comic, actual comic book universe reboot of like Flashpoint, going back in time and restarting the entire franchises over at number one with the DC new 52. But again, digression. They're trying to pit against, okay, we don't have our Superman, we don't have our Batman. So Green Arrow is kind of like Batman. He's kind of goofier. We can probably make him more lovable. We don't have to go as incredibly dark, although they do sometimes. And then we need, you know, the bright young hero who is burdened, is not coming to understand his role in a responsibility of having, you know, having a city to protect or protecting the world, but trying to find what it means to have powers, why he was given this. And it's more of the classic superhero journey, whereas Oliver's in Arrow can be seen as the darker, I've been broken down. It's a show where you spend a lot of time in Oliver's past. They've done a good job every season of creating a parallel to what's going on, to like what's he experienced on his time before he became the Green Arrow in exile. Or like when he was stranded and Leon Yu on the island, learning dark, terrible, you know, like special forces kind torture, you know, things. But so they definitely wanted to set up that kind of darker Batman Superman dynamic. But again, sorry, I just had to explain that. When you get to Batman Beyond, as well as Batman the Animated Series, and what's awesome about Batman is he just can deal with everything. You know, a lot of, you know, Mr. Freeze has a freeze gun, like that's really powerful. You know, the Joker doesn't have powers, but he's seemingly a mastermind. So those are maybe more human-esque villains from the series. But you know, you get like the Killer Croc, you get Bane. Like, Batman is fighting people with that are technically classified as metahumans. And the fact that he can take them down was one of my favorite parts of that series, and of course Batman Beyond. And they do a really good job. They did a really good job so far at the end of last season and this season, transitioning Green Arrow into more of that role. Like, oh, I need to be able to handle these type of people. The reactor spill isn't just affecting Central City. It's made its way to Starling City, blah, blah, blah. But so that's something that I like. They're kind of been able to do more in the Arrow series, as well as just admit that the people are metahumans. And the other thing that they're doing less so in The Flash, and definitely very heavily in Arrow, is the concept of introducing magic. Magic is now going to be a very huge part of the subplot of the season. The main new villain, played by Neil McDowell, you might recognize him from Band of Brothers. He's one of the dudes in the first Captain America movie on his like squad of like special like commandos. He's a very popular TV and like kind of side film actor, and he's playing Damien Dark, a character I am actually going to research this weekend, so I have a little more to talk about him next week. But he's so far does some type of blood ritual, and so far it has magic powers. He has the ability to kill someone and causing intense pain by touching them. He has magical telekinesis, which I love how they're just saying, like, people have doubted my power in the past. People think this is a parlor trick. And that's why I'm the most dangerous member of Hive. We have a new evil organization. Hive was hinted at last season by John Diggle's... Freud Laudan to John Diggle about his brother's death. And now we are actually seeing the agents of Hive, which I also know very little about. I think the only time I've actually seen Hive is... In Teen Titans, I think they first show up when Cyborg, they first show up when they send the three Jinx and her other two buddies after the Teen Titans, and then when Cyborg sets up the other Titans headquarters, I think they're the major villain with Cyborg goes undercover for a while. Oh yeah, it's great. You know what? I'm excited. I should read more. I promise you that. I'll read more about Damien Dark this weekend as well as Hive, so I have some stuff to talk about. Other than that, the other major things that these shows are doing, I'm not going to do heavy episode recaps just because, it's fun more to talk about these as a series. If huge things do come up where I get really excited about a choice, I will probably go more into recap. But right now, since we're doing three episodes, it's going to be a little rough. But most recently, this third episode of Arrow, as well as this third episode of The Flash, confirms that DC Legends of Tomorrow, is definitely going to be heavily connected to these shows. In The Flash, Ronnie Raymond, aka Firestorm, aka the guy who's in the really funny fratty guy in The Duff. I love that movie. He's just really handsome too. He's really hot. Anyway, he's super, he's very attractive in the best of ways. Every feature is just perfectly soft. Anyway, sorry. He is currently dead right now. He's Danielle Panabaker from Stuck in the Suburbs, as well as Sky High's love interest in the series, and he sacrificed himself at the end of last season to save the Central City from a singularity. He has been confirmed and is in the trailer for DC Legends of Tomorrow, and he is connected to let me remember this actor's name. Is it Victor Garber? Yeah, Victor Garber. Victor Garber, who is Dr. Stein. I always know him as Thomas Andrews from Titanic, but he's in so much more than that. He is fused with Ronnie Raymond, and he's going through some weird power glitch, getting sick, going into radioactive mode on and off, crazy stuff. So that's definitely Ronnie is probably not dead, as well as Tom Cavanaugh has already been in both ending credit, yo, so this is also happening, so keep watching. They're definitely trying to make you think he might be Zoom, the new enemy. Jay Garrick. So they're playing with the two worlds theory from comic books, another great tool that they're actually able to use in the series because it works and you can cast more people. It doesn't matter. You're not worried about it. Doesn't matter. Okay. The point is the singularity created a rip between two worlds. So despite defeating Hubar Thawn, who was played by Tom Cavanaugh, aka Dr. Wells in the first season, they opened a singularity to which Jay Garrick, the Flash in that Earth, I think they call it Earth 2. I'll explain that next week too, how multiple universes work in comic books. But Earth 2 shows up, and the anti-Flash from his universe is called Zoom. And they're definitely trying to hint that Tom Cavanaugh in that universe may be Zoom, but we are yet to know. Carlos Valdez, Cisco, is seeing his powers develop. But the main thing is Ronnie Raymond, they're definitely hinting that Ronnie Raymond is not dead. has to come back because he's been confirmed as a character on the show. I think it's something. What weird is happening with Victor Garber's character, Dr. Stein, is the key to that. So that's the big Easter egg from this week. In Arrow, we get two. So two characters last season, well, actually almost two seasons ago, died on Arrow. So Katie Lotz's character, the original Black Canary, Sarah Lance. So that's where we were like, oh, but Laurel Dinah Lance, isn't she supposed to be the Black Canary? Like when, you know, Sarah first showed up at the end of at the beginning of season two. Lo and behold, Sarah dies. Laurel does become the Black Canary, yet Sarah has been confirmed and is now been resurrected with the Lazarus Pit. Hence, she is going to become the White Canary as confirmed on DC Legends of Tomorrow. This is definitely a deep comic book reference, but if you also check this movie out, Batman Under the Red Hood, it's about a Robin named Jason Todd who is resurrected with the Lazarus Pit and like kind of goes crazy psycho and like starts killing people and becomes this character known as the Red Hood. Sarah's definitely going through that right now. She's like chained up and she's lost her mind. It's been hinted in like press releases or on the wiki at least that John Constantine, a show which has been canceled by NBC but confirmed in this universe, is somehow going to help Sarah deal with the like, okay, quote from the show, Malcolm Merlyn says, "The Lazarus Pit doesn't just restore life from you, it maintains the presence and souls of all the previous people who've used it, and so it requires like a price." So Thea, who used it to heal herself, is like feeling like killing people all the time. Sarah just doesn't remember who she is. So if there's like the spirit or like possession kind of thing, I can see how Constantine might slip in there. I don't know, that might be kind of cool, but if that does happen, I really hope they cast the Welsh actor from who also does the voice in Black Flag from NBC's Constantine, because he was great. That was arguably one of my favorite NBC shows last year, because I'm not liking Heroes Reborn, and Blindspot is okay, but I think I just read too many like reviews about it being just meh that I just like, I don't know, I'll probably watch it because I like Jamie Alexander. It's just like, I just feel like, okay, why doesn't AMC do this show? And then just do it better, because screw a tattooed MacGuffin. Anyway, so she's been brought back to life. The other major hint, and yet another character from directly from the show of Arrow that's going to be brought back on DC Legends of Tomorrow, is Ray Palmer, aka the Atom, which they have changed a little bit from, a lot from the comic books, in the sense that he is now in a super, it's kind of like the Iron Man of the series that figures out how to use it to make himself incredibly small. He arguably, as a comic book fan, if I were a hardcore one, would piss me off the most, because like it's not who he really is in the comics, I believe, but I don't know 100%, but he died at the end of last season as well, or when he tried to use the shrink suit. Felicity has been getting weird coded messages on her phone. Felicity, played by the wonderful Emily Bette Ricard, who, if you listen to Aisha Tyler's Girl on Guy podcast, you should definitely listen to her episode. She is a treasure and a wonderful person. She just sounds like a wonderful human being. But anyway, Felicity is now getting mysterious, like, coded messages on her phone that say her name, and I'm pretty sure it's Ray somehow in cyberspace. Not dead, because they've already showed that he's not dead, because he's coming back on the show called DC Legends of Tomorrow. But, so those are the big hints. I'm curious to see how that develops within the individual series, if they do more crossovers, but I'm really curious to how they're going to set up this multi-hero, their Justice League-like franchise. It is involved with Rip Hunter, who's a time traveler from the comic books, so I believe they might be going to the future to fight crime, or they might be going to an alternate reality, but they're definitely not going to be with their main characters, the characters from the main series, I believe. So I'm curious, super excited, very curious to see where it goes. Fingers crossed they don't fuck it up. But, you know, speaking of longevity, I give Arrow another good 2 to 3 seasons. I give The Flash a good 4 seasons, but I could see this imploding soon, because I think people are getting tired of superheroes, and I think Star Wars is going to change the game. When Star Wars comes out this December, it could change every paradigm I have in my head, and I don't know. But also be on the lookout for Star Wars Rebels. Great great series. I think it's back on Disney XD. Fingers crossed for to see it return. It's no Clone Wars, but it's okay. It kind of feels like Firefly. Wow, super digressions. I'm sorry. Star Wars was awesome. I watched that trailer like 12 times. I fucking love that series so much. I love this cast. Okay, I'm sorry. Breathe it in, Steven. The Jedi wouldn't freak out like this. I know I wouldn't be a Jedi. I'd probably be a fucking... Okay, sorry. Let's transition out of the CW world. We still have a lot more to talk about there in the future. I love talking about it with you guys. I'm going to try contain it to hopefully just a CW episode in the future. But let's switch gears to Steven Soderbergh's The Nick. And I'm going to try my darndest to write an article about this tomorrow, but we will just see. Steven Soderbergh's The Nick is arguably, it's becoming a very Mad Men-like to me. It's nowhere near as symbolic, well-written, et cetera, as Mad Men. That show's a fucking masterpiece. But this show is just utter genius, and it's so fascinating. Sorry, when I breathe through my teeth like that, I whistle. So this is its second season, and I didn't talk about this a ton because it had already ended by the time I started this podcast, kind of awkwardly. I think it was like March, and then I didn't talk about anything for a really long time. But so to break down why I love the first season is Steven Soderbergh is clearly behind the camera the entire time. It is shot so differently and cut and edited so differently from anything else on television, in the same sense True Detective is, in the same sense Fargo is, in the same sense Mad Men and Breaking Bad were. What Fargo does with its lightness, its thematicism, its great use of non-diegetic sound. I think the scoring choices, especially this season, have been absolutely fantastic, as well as the use of just, you know, empty space. Empty, and that's what you notice more with prestige television. You see more choice scoring, like going back to what we were just talking about, Arrow and The Flash, all the musical choices feel very driven, like they drive you to feel like a certain feeling. And all sound designers do that, okay? But what these other shows do is they play around a lot more with a lack of sound. Like, listen to just scenes in Fargo as it, you know, as people are just having a conversation in a room. You'll see, like, the establishing medium or long shot or just of everyone in the room talking, but there's absolutely nothing but diegetic sound, which I think is just so fun to look at as an art piece. You think, oh, okay. Well, I like to think it puts you in the head of the characters a lot more. Sometimes, again, I don't have a problem with scoring. One of the main reasons I love anime is because the scoring is so perfect for what I'm watching. But again, this is more as like, I'm trying to tell something different. I'm trying to be more an auteur. The Nick does it so well. And I'm going to set it up this way. And I talk about this in the period episode. I believe that's episode 2 of this podcast. The Nick doesn't use any period music. It occasionally uses, probably because there aren't a ton of audio recordings from this time. They're like early phonographs, but like this is 1900, season 2, 1901. Okay. Electricity was just being installed in this hospital. And so what's fascinating about this show is that, you know, you're looking at a very detailed period environment, you know, down to the streets, the clothing, not a ton of the dialogue, but, you know, the kind of the accents you would believe people would have, the dialogue choices people would have. You aren't getting those non-diegetic and even sometimes diegetic audio cues that like Martin Scorsese loves, that like cheaper period television like BBC television loves. You know, we associate a period with a sound. We associate the Wild West like Hell on Wheels, which I probably should have started watching. I'll probably check that out again. I've lost a lot of faith in AMC. You know, the intro is like the thwang of the banjo. It wants to make you feel like you're not so much in the South in a contemporary sense, but like in the old Wild West. You know, the jaunty organ and accordion of like the black sails intro to Black Sails, the Stars of Pirate Treasure Island series, or like the dun 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 of the Musketeers on BBC, like or even I bring this up, and Sherlock doesn't do this all the time, but dun 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 dun, like we're all so cued in, like it brings us directly into those shows, and it's all very calculated scoring that's absolutely fascinating and incredibly well done. And that's a whole nother episode to talk about. But what's great about the Nick is it does none of that. Clive Owen gets in a carriage, and all we hear is this weird synthesizer. And this is continued into season two. And it's literally like nothing organic sounding. That's the huge part about it. Like sounds usually sound organic. And what's fascinating about the Nick is that nothing is organic about it at all. It's like you hear the clodding of horse hooves, but other than that, you hear the boom, 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 That's crazy. Like, that's almost music I feel like you would hear, when you see a bunch of, like, people in suits walking towards, like, a nuclear launch site. You know, like, sir, we need to move to DEFCON 4 and move you underground. And you just hear, like, you see cuts of people, like, typing on computers and hear, like, doom, 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 doom. Like, it's so out of place. And what I love about it is that I think, I don't know if this is the sound designer himself or Steven Soderbergh or someone else on the production team, but it's definitely them trying to say, hey, like, we're in 1900, and this is over 100 years ago, but we're not that different. And it plays with that idea so beautifully. And you're constantly presented with contrast and as well as similarities throughout every episode. And it's so fun to find. It's so fun to look at through the lens of an experienced director like Steven Soderbergh. In season two premiere, you see Algernon Edwards, who's the Black Doctor, who's now head of surgery with Clive Owen's character Thackeray's absence, just waiting in the hallway. Because despite being one of the reasons the hospital is doing so well, he's not respected because he's black, because it's 1900 and he's an European educated doctor who was raised by a wealthy New York family, but he's still black. That's such a foreign idea because, we like to think we're better than that now. And clearly by things that are going on today, we are. Or we're better about talking about it, but it isn't. So when you see him waiting there and you hear that reminder of modernity, that boom, 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 you just are constantly dragged back and forth between, fuck, this is so bizarre and foreign. Like, I can't believe this happened to, like, people still go through that today, And that to me is really powerful. And I know the show has its loopholes in terms of expanding its casting to minorities, as well as offering like better supporting roles to women and minorities. But season two's done real justice to these characters so far, and season one didn't do them a ton of disjustice. I just understand that like this is a show. The first scene is about a brilliant, arrogant white doctor who uses cocaine to solve his problems, and the first two episodes kind of come off as being like, is this the same old arrogant white male protagonist of period television that has plagued television for a while? And it's not. Because it's the pieces around Thackeray that make him fascinating. And something season two has done really, really well so far is Eric Gallinger, the more hardcore racist in the first season, whose wife is kind of losing herself to mental illness when their child dies, et cetera, et cetera. I'll let you watch more of the series. We'll do a heavier recap next week. They brought him back in the best way possible. I thought he was going to fizzle. I thought his story was going to end because he just sucked. He was not interesting. He was an asshole. And like, he wasn't an asshole in an interesting way that Thackeray was. And now he's still an asshole, but he has plays in his book. Thackeray is no longer the arrogant white doctor because he's now the arrogant white, I'm an addict dealing with addiction. And like Everett is the one that's bringing him back to the fold. Like they have their own side plot this entire episode, whereas the hospital where you see Jeremy Bob's character, the Nick, where everything takes place, is Andre's realm right now. But more importantly, moving on from what I think about the soundtrack and bringing it closer to, you know, a non-organicness to what is a time without electronics. Like, it's so evident even in surgery scenes. You know, we're so used to seeing, like, ER and hearing, like, beep, 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 da-na-na-na-na. You know, everything is dictated by an electronic sound. There is no electricity. There's no heart rate monitor. Do you know what the first surgery scene, the pulse machine is? It's the nurse holding the hand and seeing the pulse with a watch and being like, this is what the pulse is now. This is what the pulse is now. No beeping. The only background noise is the constant cranking of that, because there were no electric pumps yet, or gas pumps yet. The electric hand cranking pump to pump blood out of a surgical incision. What I'm getting at here, guys, with sound is it makes you think. Shows often choose not to make us think like that because it wants you to fit into the mold, into the period that it's setting so exactly, almost like you're sitting on stage with the character sometime, but more or less so that you're kind of like, this is the world that they've established, these are the boundaries, this is the characters, this is the thematic lore, etc., this is the scenery. I'm either there or I'm watching it, but that's how it's boxed. The Nick does that, but it constantly is dragging you in and out of this, in and out of this, in a way that I absolutely love. Because I love period television. I love accents. I love that. Oh, there's a man named Thomas Sullivan who's a cop. Oh, sorry, that's the actor's name. I think his last name is O'Leary. He's a cop, you know, an ambulance driver, but he's here for just what great relationship with this Irish Catholic nun who's, you know, in jail for doing abortions. Like, I love accents. I love everything that period brings, probably because I saw Braveheart when I was like 4 years old, 5 years old. Again, too early. But it is everything Steven Soderbergh does to challenge those principles in the series that make it fascinating, avant-garde, and a must-watch on television. It is very hard to watch. Season 2, the main surgery scene we were treated to was the draining of a pus-filled incision. Yeah, so be ready for that type of material. But beyond the gore, that also is something that's more organic as well. Because, you know, despite society and technology changing, our bodies haven't changed a ton. You know, the way we think about it maybe has. But, you know, at the end of the day, they're operating on this person on a table, cutting him open. And it's kind of a reminder, you know, at the end of the day, deep down inside, we're all just still people. We're all just still people dealing with, you know, our humanity, it's just society, you know, our personality, our weird psychology, everything that Freud brings up after this series after this period the series focuses on is over, you know. And it's doing a great job of illustrating the rise of modernity, more so than any show I've ever seen before tackle a period like this, like more than Boardwalk Empire, more than Peaky Blinders. It's just so thought-provoking. You want to analyze every scene. You want to get inside every character's head. You want to fight for all of these characters in the show. I guess more so, I just really want to sit down with Steven Soderbergh. My job, other than recapping next week when I talk about the Nick, well, I will do talk more about the Nick production process as well as the writer, because I don't think Steven Soderbergh writes this. And the first season, sometimes you can tell the writing struggles, and it's more Soderbergh's directorial influence, kind of like a Nick Pizzolatto, Cary Fukunaga scene, that definitely takes over on camera, on the screen. But the symbolism and the thematicism and looking at the technical way this show is put together are the three things you should be looking for when watching this series. Season 2 has given me everything I've wanted for this show and more. It's kept the theme of obsession at the forefront of its imagery, of its characters. It's at the core of what makes this show amazing. It's what connects the actors and the writing to Steven Soderbergh's lens, to that dissonant music. Is like, you want to feel safe in this period. You want to feel like this period is safe from outside influence, from like, you want to feel like you can escape there, like most TV experiences, and you can, but in your headspace, there's always going to be a voice challenging it, challenging you, challenging who you are when you watch this show. And it's very hard for a series to do that for me. Usually it's hitting up, you know, the right neurons to be like, oh yeah, he's the bad guy's going down, or like, oh no, that's super emotional, I've like felt that way. And like, you hear that big like horn swelling, or something like that. Okay, sorry, there are a lot of personal sound effects this show, just that's the way I think. You feel all of those sounds connected with the imagery you're seeing swell inside you. And that has given us a safe medium for what we expect from both movies and television, which is why I encourage people to watch more off the beaten path, more indie type of television and film all the time. Because when those ideas are challenged, you discover not just new things about what you're watching on television, like when you watch a show without those things, when you watch a show with more of those things, when you watch a movie without or with those things, but you discover more about yourself, more about what you look for. Like, I love watching a show like The Nick with my personal knowledge of like how medicine works, or like how my personal opinions of science and God. And I love talking to my friend who has a completely different set of views on that. Yet at the same time, despite being moved in different directions necessarily, we can identify the same tools, the same moments, the same sounds that drive us to those places. And everything feels very purposeful of that, in a way that Mad Men, in my opinion, takes more time with. The best way to think about The Nick is it's kind of like, I'm trying to make a metaphor that's actually relatable. I'm terrible at making ones that are relatable. The Nick, okay, we'll start with Mad Men. Mad Men in my opinion is like being on like a boat ride. It's a smooth boat ride that sometimes gets a little choppy, but you're just progressing through the water. Some people are going to get off the boat. You're going to see people do things who aren't on the boat, but you know, they just wave past you and you're there with them. You're exploring their world, and it's a pretty enjoyable time. I go to the man in the storm, or the man in the boat kind of painting scene in Good Will Hunting. It's a show where you can really sit back within the episode, watch it once or twice and reflect and think and look for things, you know, like with open eyes and wonder. What The Nick is it's more like you're on a speedboat. A speedboat that's stopping on different little islands to like explore. It's like going back and forth from place to place, because it's not a fast-paced show. But in terms of what it's showing you, it's a lot more aggressive. Ah, God, I'm sorry. These were terrible metaphors. But it's a lot more aggressive than Mad Men in throwing its themes at you and throwing its symbolism at you. And it's kind of obvious the show is making you think a lot more. Whereas Mad Men, again, you're kind of experiencing the vibe and that leads you to think. Whereas this is, you're watching really crazy things happen and you're listening to really crazy things and you're trying to piece it all together very, very quickly, or because you just want to know. But okay, I'm running out of things to say. We're at 43 minutes here, guys. I'm sorry about that. But just going over quickly the cast of this series, just because I feel like I owe these people that much because they're providing me with such great entertainment. Clive Owen, as you know, I just watched King Arthur, 2003 classic on Netflix. Great series with Keira Knightley, great movie with Keira Knightley. He is Dr. John Thackeray of this series, a brilliant surgeon with a drug problem. Andre Holland, I believe he's done a lot of TV comedy acting, I think he was on that show Friends with Benefits. I don't even remember what network that was on, but he's very good in this as well. He was a little stiff at the beginning of the first season, but I see why so. And he turns out to be a fascinating character. And he also did an interview with Andy Greenwald on the Andy Greenwald podcast that you also should check out on Grantland. Jeremy Bob, I think he's been more of a stage actor recently. Plays the head of the hospital, who's very corrupt, taking bribes and is owes money to the mob a lot. Juliet Ryland is the daughter of one of the founders of the Knickerbocker Hospital, one of the main businessmen that, you know, fund the hospital. And she is kind of trying to bake the mold of what it means to be a woman at this time. Like, remember, they don't have the vote yet. And she's a wealthy woman trying to do good and try to figure out. She's obsessed with helping because she thinks by helping people, she'll figure out how to help herself, how to make herself feel like a good person again. And she's played by, Juliet Ryland, a British actress, I believe. I don't know too much else she's done, but she's very wonderful. And I think she has a couple late-night TV appearances on, like, Leno and Fallon, as well as Letterman. The big name in this that's kind of funny is Eve Hewson, and you won't recognize that name. You might if you just saw Bridge of Spies or plan on seeing Bridge of Spies, but this is actually Bono's daughter, and she plays the nurse from West Virginia who's very curious and looks very innocent, and she's the one that develops this kind of obsession with John Thackeray. She's just so attracted to him for some reason. And my favorite on the show is actually Micah Agron, I always look up his name, Angorono. He's the character from Sky High, or my favorite, he's the kid who has a tumor in Lords of Dogtown. He's absolutely wonderful in this series. His Bertie Chickering, he's like the young bright-eyed doctor with a heart of gold, and I'm interested to see his character take on a few more dimensions in the series. And we'll end it with Chris Sullivan, who plays Thomas O'Leary, the Irish-American ambulance driver who has his own, you know, subversive ways of getting money and his own view on the world and such. And Sister Clary, who's played by Kara Seymour, wonderful actress. She's a really good nun. And at first you kind of don't like her because she's skeptical of medicine, but you see that she's really the heavy other feminist character in the series. She is fighting for women's rights in a time. Well, she doesn't. She's not openly fighting for women's rights, but that's what her character basically stands for. And Maya Kazan, who you might recognize if you kept watching Boardwalk Empire as Maybell, Nucky's love interest from his younger days when they kept doing the flashbacks in the final season. She's also playing a pretty tragic character. She is the wife Eric Johnson, who plays Dr. Gallinger, the racist asshole doctor who's more interesting this season, who loses her mind after her child dies and witnesses why medicine wasn't always sought out in 1900, because she goes to a mental health clinic and they do really bad things to her. Not rape things, but just like disturbing medical things, like they pull out all her teeth and stuff, because apparently if the brain is sick and we know bacteria causes infection, the brain must be getting infected from somewhere. I did the same process with all my children to make sure the gums are clear and of filth and disease that might be affecting the brain. Terrifying. I got chills when I heard that. I had to pause it. But anyway, guys, thanks so much for listening. This is almost a 50-minute podcast. I'll make sure to add a note in the subtext of where the discussion about what and what start. But I appreciate everyone listening in. Hopefully tomorrow we'll be doing actually a short podcast on Shonda Thursdays. I need to catch up with How to Get Away with Murder. And keep in mind, I don't watch Grey's Anatomy because it's not Scrubs, and Scrubs is the best medical show ever. Bye, guys. Thanks for listening. This was Storytime with Tofu. Keep listening to Carly Rae Jepsen and feel that emotion. Da, da, da. My sound effects will end this show. Goodbye, bye, bye.